Hello there and welcome back to the shortest history of Britain. On this episode, we're going to be covering the thousand-year period that spans between the Roman invasions and the Norman invasion in 1066. A huge amount of time, so much happening, and so much to get through. So as always, we're going to be skimming the surface just a little to get through it all. Now, at the end of the last episode, we left Britain on the back of numerous Roman invasions. Julius Caesar had twice been across, he'd conquered and had since left. Caligula had had a go and largely failed. Until in 43 AD, Claudius, the leader of the Roman Empire, had gathered his troops and had made landfall onto British soil. So after those numerous attempted invasions, Britain had been returned to Celtic power and was largely still fending for itself. The Celtic tribes had taken hold of the various parts of the land, and an infighting between them was common. It was rife and it was very brutal. Kings had claimed their thrones, ruling their people and battling with each other for anything and everything between the various regions of Britain. The Catavellauni, who were one of the biggest and most powerful tribes in the south of the country at least, had tried and failed to join the tribes together and to hold back Caesar's second invasion. Now to the east, in what is now Essex and Suffolk, the Trinovantes were considered possibly the most powerful tribe in the land, and they were bordered to the north in what is now Norfolk by the Iceni's. Now the Iceni's were led by the powerful warrior queen Boudicca, who would go on to be one of the main aggressors who led the defence of the nation against the invasion of the Romans, which was to come. She's become a cult hero, a symbol of power for the little man versus the giant, the David versus the Goliath. Now, unfortunately, her fortune wasn't quite as favourable as David's was, but we'll get to that. She was described as tall, terrifying, long hair down below her waist, a loud voice, a harsh voice, a very unique sense of dress. She was often described as wearing a long, colourful coat fastened just at the neck with a brooch. Now, over in Rome, they had given the power of the empire to the first emperor of the dynasty, Augustus, and he intended to finally take Provincia Britannia, the province of Great Britain, of Britain as it was, for Rome. Now we end the millennium, and we move into the years which are henceforth known as AD, Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. Now it wasn't actually called this until about the year 525, when Dionysius the Humble, who was a senior monk in Rome, described as the most learned abbot in the city of Rome, created the AD system as a way of enumerating the years of his Easter table. And from then on, it was more widely adopted therein in both the Gregorian calendar and the Christianized version of the Julian calendar too. Of course, what caused this change between BC and AD was the birth of Christ. But it would be more than 300 years before the Roman Empire would adopt Christianity as a religion, partly due to the empire's failings, war, poverty, famine, violence, a lot of hard work for no money. Again, we'll come to that. Before that, the Romans believed in what we now know as the Roman gods. So Jupiter, Juno, Mars, Mercury, Neptune, Venus, you can see the pattern here, Apollo, Diana, Minerva, Vulcan, there are some others. Back to Britain, which of course is the point here. So Claudius crossed the channel from Boulogne to Richborough on the east coast of Kent, though this isn't certain. There was a Roman historian who kept great records of what was going on at the time. He wrote over 80 volumes of an early history of Rome and the Empire. And He has notes on Claudius's invasion and does state that the secondary force of the invasion left from the Boulogne area, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they all did. So, in fact, there's a very reasonable chance that they didn't. And again, Richborough may not be correct as a landing point. The records state that the passage was east to west. Now, from Boulogne to Richborough is almost perfectly from south to north. So, again, there are theories that the invasion took land at the Solent and landed near Southampton or Chichester, and we're likely to never know. Archaeological evidence suggests Roman artifacts in all of these locations from around that time. So the huge Catalavani tribe was ruled by a great king called Cunobeline. He died just a few years prior, and his two sons, Togodumnus and Caraticus, led this huge defence of the land from the invading Roman legions. So one of the first and the biggest battles was the Battle of Medway, which is near where Rochester is now, and went on for a couple of days. It was a very fair battle, very even battle. At one point, the commanding general was very close to being captured, the Roman general, but actually managed to survive, and by the end of the second day, swung the battle back into the favour of the Romans. Now, the British were pushed gradually back and back and until they retreated almost as far as the Thames. Togodumnus was killed, the British began to fall, and the final call for Claudius to come to the battlefield to declare victory from Rome, in which he brought with him a pack of war elephants, eventually claimed the surrender of the remaining kings of southern England. And over the next decade or so, they pushed west across the country, taking the land for themselves as they went, with little great bloodshed, really, until they could form a base in what is now Exeter. A legion from there was sent north, building a road as they went, until they reached the city of what is now Lincoln. And that road still stands, it's Foss Way. It marked at the time, and clearly still does, a very apparent diagonal line from southwest into a northeasterly direction up into Lincoln, under which everything became under Roman rule. The Romans established settlement in London, then called Londinium, in the year 50. Other early settlements at the time were in places like St. Albans or Verulamium, Cirencester, Winchester, Colchester, Lincoln, of course, Gloucester, Dorchester, Bath. When they finally pushed north, and again we'll come to this in a few moments, they created places like Chester, York, Manchester. As you can tell from the names here, Winchester, Gloucester, Dorchester, Manchester, Chester, this word Chester that we use actually denotes a Roman settlement. It comes from the word used for a fort or from a military camp, and on occasion can actually just be the word used for the fort or the military location itself. But virtually every word that we have ending in Chester is from that origin. Also, we could also use Caster, as in Lancaster or Doncaster or Tadcaster, Muncaster. I'm sure there are many more. Now, from this point, they pushed west. Now, the warrior tribe of the Silures caused huge problems for the Roman legions. They were really great guerrilla warfare tacticians and frequently took the upper hand on the vastly better armed and better numbered Romans. They would take frequent hostages and then travel around to the neighbouring factions and tribes in an order to bring them together into a more solid collective war effort. And it's not quite known whether they were eventually defeated militarily or whether they simply agreed to surrender, but they were certainly remembered as great warriors who fought incredibly well against the much more favourable odds. Now, the Roman Tacitus, who was this note-keeper, this documentarist, who we're able to refer back to get an indication of some of the things that were going on at the time. He made a comment in one of his notes that the tribes there in Wales were changed neither by cruelty nor clemency. So in the year 60 or 61, with the Romans sweeping across the country, having faced down much of Wales and pushing to the borders of Scotland, which was this wild place that they would struggle in the entirety to ever conquer, the people of the south were beginning an uprising. Queen Boudica, or Boudicea, was leader of the Iceni tribe after the death of her husband. Now, he'd largely been a Roman ally, a Roman sympathist. The Romans had come to an arrangement with him regarding the succession of his kingdom upon his death. But when they failed to honour it, the tribes of the south began to revolt, and a formal revolution and defence was planned, with Boudica chosen as the leader. They'd seen how their ancestors had eventually driven Julius Caesar from the shores of Britain and regained their independence into Celtic hands, and they'd heard the stories coming out of Germany of people like Arminius who had done the same in the lands there, and again they took inspiration from this. So they began to push back against the Romans. They created this conglomerate, this gathered army, and they pushed to Colchester, where they completely decimated the Roman legions there. The Romans sent for reinforcements from Catus, but the 200 men that he did send didn't last even a day there, and the revolting hordes, the revolting Celtic tribes, were boosted in number further, and then also in this confidence from their victories. So the Roman governor was called Suetonius Paulinus, and when he heard of this uprising, he fled on horseback with only a few men, riding right through enemy territory until he could reach Londinium. London, as it wasn't a huge settlement, and it was a significant way from being any form of capital city, but it had started to establish itself as a central hub for trade. And so the governor amassed what legions he had there, and he began to take preparations for battle. He quickly realised that the men he had were nowhere near enough. He was nowhere near armed enough to go to battle against the huge hordes of the Celts, who were very intent on fighting to reclaim their land. So he decided, as the Celts neared, to flee and abandon the Roman settlement of Londinium to the rebels. Catus in turn fled back to France, and London was burned to the ground, with all the remaining Roman inhabitants killed where they were found, women and children included. The attitude, even as the townsfolk pleaded against it, was to sacrifice the town, people and all, in the name of saving the larger province. So it was a very deliberate losing of the battle in order to win the war, and London was torched. So the Romans rallied, and they called in auxiliary troops, which brought legions from across the country and then up from Spain, until they stood with an army of 10,000 or so men. Now, at this point, Boudica's army stood at 200,000 men, though, to be honest, again, this number's quite uncertain. It comes from the writings of the Romans, who would likely have exaggerated the numbers in these stories. We all know, of course, that the Romans must have won the war here. So they met at a place on Watling Street, though it does run from Canterbury to Shropshire, which is some 270-something miles. So there's a lot of road there that it could have perhaps happened on. Some say near St Albans, some Leicestershire, some Birmingham, even south near Epping Forest. There's archaeological evidence to support all of these, and likely we're never going to really know. But the Romans defeated the Celts, claiming to have killed 80,000 men before the rest then fled. Again, this narrative is probably not entirely correct. We do have some little written evidence on it to support the story, but again, what's written on the subject was written by the Romans. So, regardless, at the end of the battle, Boudica took poison of some sort and fell dead, defeated. Though, again, possibly disputable, it's thought she may have just fallen ill and died quite quickly. She was given a very lavish burial by her people and her two daughters, and no records remain of what happened to them afterwards. And to this day, she remains this cult hero in British history. So, The Romans began to push north. They pushed north into Scotland, or Caledonia as they called it, in the years 79 or 80, working their way around the coastlines with naval fleets and then pushing inland with these legions of foot troops. They took through force much of the land, securing forts in the highlands and in the lowlands. And in the year 84, they set up this network of military forts to secure the area and finally consolidated control of the region. However, a few years later, there seemed to be very little profit coming out of Caledonia, and the amount of effort needed to survive up there, to keep the locals at bay, to ship goods from the south, to maintain farming, to maintain trade, was really not seen as worth it to the Romans, and eventually they retreated gradually south. It seems that it would be easier to allow a passive surrender by the local tribes there and then just to allow them to be. So they retreated south and formed a border near Carlisle, where they set up an office for the region commander and created a border from Carlisle at the west to Corbridge at the east, which is just a few miles west of Newcastle on the A69, I believe. In the year 122, the Emperor Hadrian built the wall, which we now know as Hadrian's Wall, which formed part of this protective border into the wild and the rugged lands of the free Caledonia. Now, much of it does still stand, though it's not anywhere near the border these days. It runs 73 miles, although this was 80 Roman miles, which were clearly slightly different, from the Solway Firth at the west, which, for those not in on their British geography, is the huge wash, the inlet that forms the western boundary of the two countries just north of Carlisle and Cumbria, and runs across to Wallsend on the River Tyne in the east. Now, 20 years later, they pushed north again and they constructed the Antonine Wall between the Firth and the Clyde, which is one of the narrowest parts of the Scottish mainland. Though again, this was abandoned not long after, and the border retreated back south to where it currently resides, though again, not the exact place. It would move many times over the years. From around the year 200 AD, any real foray into the lands of Caledonia was generally peaceful. Explorations into the land that ran between these two walls, so not venturing northwards into the wilds and the mountains, was still fiercely protected by warrior Celts. Now, the Romans went on explorations into the southern parts of the country to trade, to bribe, to negotiate, and eventually, not long later, to spread the word of Christianity. And so, with that, the Romans had established themselves across England and Wales, very little into Scotland and Ireland, and Roman Britain, as we know it, began. A great Roman-British culture began to develop, and advances were made in the fields of agriculture, in industrial production. An economy was built, so people had jobs and professions and training. Records show that 258 different recorded professions in Rome at that time. So fishermen, miners, hunters, craftsmen, salt dealers, metal workers, herders, butchers, stonesmiths, entertainers, dancers, musicians, goldsmiths and silversmiths and blacksmiths. So it began this boom, this economic boom in what would become Britain. However, back home in Rome, the Roman Empire was having significant problems of its own. In the south of the continent, they were being bombarded with barbarian invasions, fragmenting their hold over the various parts of their land. Leaders there were turning on one another, and there was civil war. Murder plots were forming between rivaling generals and commanders. You had these underhand agreements and these secret pacts that were being made between corrupt officials and leaders of the Saxons and the Franks, which was leading to further division. And so as the 4th century progressed and the Scots and the Picts grew in number and in confidence, they began to war down from the north and push back against the Romans, whilst there were also battles starting against the Scotti or the Gaels from Ireland on the western front, and also from the Saxons who were coming out of Germania at the east. And so the Romans began to build these shoreline forts to repel the attacks from the seas. But it was largely too late, and the Picts, the Scots, the Saxons, the Gaels, Roman deserters at the time, a group called the Atacotti, all combined their forces and took Hadrian's Wall back from the Romans. It was called the Barbarian Conspiracy, or sometimes just the Great Conspiracy. And so, as the situation in Rome worsened, the empire began to weaken across the continent. It was losing its power, and it was losing its men. As it shifted legions from one place to another, it was leaving these forts that it had constructed abandoned, and they were quickly raided and ransacked in Britain. Forts in places like Chester and the forts of North Wales were very quickly swept up and taken by the invading Irish, and the Romans lost their footing in the area. So coupled with all this decline, the economy began to fall. However, there is evidence of housing being built from this time, and things like new mosaic floors from the period that were being laid, indicating that the economy, whilst dropping and struggling in places, may have only been doing so on a local or a regional basis, and that certain areas of the country were still very profitable. Canterbury, Wroxeter, Gloucester, Winchester, all still remained very kind of big, decent towns with big farming communities and wide, fertile plots of land in their control. So from around the year 400, with these barbarian attacks coming very swift and fast, and with the Roman legions now largely gone, there began to reappear the rule of the local warlords as they had been before the Roman arrival some 400 years prior. They took control of the administration of the regions, the law, the economic distribution, and the justice of the land, while maintaining many of the Roman customs and traditions that had previously stood. And by the year 400, the Saxons had swept across much of southern Britain, and many of the Britons began to flee across the Channel into Brittany, hence the name, and into Ireland and down into Spain. Final appeals were made to the generals of the Roman Empire, pleading for assistance in keeping back these invaders, but they were largely unanswered. Over in the Roman Empire, Rome was busy dealing with its own problems, and in 410, the Visigoths, these Germanic people from the west, led by their king Alaric, completely sacked Rome and slaughtered its people. So, historically, these towns, these big Roman towns such as Bath, Winchester, Gloucester, Chichester, fell to the Saxons, and this next chapter in our history begins. So in the year 410, the Romans had retreated and left the island of Britain. The Germanic people to the west had been on the land for a while whilst the Romans were here, but as the Romans began to depart, it left this space which the Germanic tribes swiftly filled. We knew these people as the Angles and the Saxons, and they began to create what would be known as the Anglo-Saxon culture, which was this mix, of course, between these Germanic people and the inhabitants of Britain as it was with this great Roman influence. The Anglo-Saxon Britain remained all the way through to the Norman invasion 600 years or so later. So its presence here continued on for longer than that of the Romans indeed did. It would continue on through the repeated attempted invasions of the Vikings across the late 700s and the Danes of 865, all the way through to that Norman invasion in 1066. There's much discussion and analysis which remains around historians as to the extent of this immigration of Saxon people. Some say that there was this mass migration which swarmed the island, overpowering and outnumbering the Britons to such an extent that they assumed control by default. But some contest that it wasn't actually the case, and that it was merely a band of elite Saxons who arrived here. And And there's theory that they could both have happened, a mass migration to some areas and this band of elite focusing on overpowering smaller areas. So Britain was divided into a heptarchy, so seven ruling kingdoms. And they were as follows: Northumbria, Mercia, Anglia, Essex, Wessex, Sussex, and Kent. The most powerful of these were Kent and Anglia, with their ruling kings holding much sway over the rest of the land. But there was civil war everywhere, and soon Northumbria would grow to rival these southern kingdoms, and again, war would prevail across the years. Now, Christianity had been adopted in the Roman Empire and was the official religion, and it had indeed been introduced here in around the year 330, but it wasn't widely adopted. But in around the year 600, probably a few years prior to that, in about 597, the Roman Pope Gregory I sent Augustine of Canterbury, who would become the first Archbishop of Canterbury, the Apostle of the People, to evangelize the British. He built the See of Canterbury and began to travel the lands of the south of Britain to convert the population to Christianity. Much of the north had already been converted by travelling bishops of the Irish Church, who were also on this mission to spread Christianity. And whilst some of Britain remained pagan for years to come, the Roman Church did deem its mission a success. Now, it must be said, however, that it was deemed a success if the ruling king of a region agreed to be baptized, regardless of whether or not he and his people actually adopted any Christian practices or beliefs. And so with this Christianization of the country came an education too. Many people were learning to read and to write for the first time. And whilst the Christian beliefs were starting to be adopted more widely, these original pagan beliefs which had been followed prior continued throughout the country. And it's why we see this crossover of Christian and pagan imagery and symbolism and belief, even in modern times. We see, if we look at celebrations like Christmas, for example, this blending of pagan and Christian symbology, which was thought to ease this transition into this new, quite forced religion. So wreaths, Christmas trees, candles, even the date of Christmas Day was brought in line with pagan tradition, and the cross symbol was actually also a pagan symbol too. Hymns, carols, chants, blessings, forgiveness, even the crown of thorns were all pagan before they were Christian. Now in the 8th century, raiders from across the waters in Scandinavia, so mainly Danish and Norwegian, crossed the waves and plundered much of Europe, crashing down onto British shores. We knew them as the Vikings, and they raided and ransacked the churches and the monasteries, which were historically these centres for wealth. Small raids continued until about 860, when they then turned into a full-blown invasion by the Great Viking Army, which was known to people then as the Great Heathen Army. Within 10 years, they'd taken all the British kingdoms but Wessex, and the ruling king Alfred built a fortress there, deep in the marshes of Somerset, and began to amass an army capable of pushing back against the Danes. And amass an army he did, defeating the Vikings in battle and pushing them back from the west coast right back to the east. Now, Alfred's reign and the reign of his successors, especially if we look at Edward the Elder, who reigned from 899 to 924, were important in unifying the country and creating this new sense of British identity. The Britons retook much of the south of the country, confining the Danes into Anglia and parts of the north. So King Alfred of Wessex reorganized these armies into a proper military. He built a navy, he fortified towns to protect assets, which would go on to be known as boroughs, and it's where we get the suffix Borough are now in our place names, or Bury, which is, we see them in places across the country now, in places like Salisbury, Banbury, Edinburgh, Loughborough, Market Harborough. Again, I challenge you to think of all of them. King Alfred's tenacity in his work was successful, and he gradually pushed the Danes further and further back until in 896 they dispersed entirely and they disappeared from the land. Alfred presented himself as the champion of Christianity and paved the way for this new culture. He began, and his successors would continue, a consolidation of the counties, creating a unified Britain. He created public courts as this link between rulers and freemen, and as a means of assessing taxes, and even created military service. Now, in 946, Edred would be described as the first king of the English, and his successor, Edgar the Peaceful, in 959, would be the first man to be crowned officially as such at a ceremony in Bath. Across the 990s and the thousands, so just into the turn of the century, the Danes had been pushing back again at the British shores, and under Ethelred the Unready, in 1010, the British were finally overthrown by a large-scale Danish attack. The Danish leader was called Canute, and he agreed to split the land with Ethelred's son, Edmund Ironside. Unfortunately, Edmund died not long after the agreement, and the land went completely under the control of Canute and the Danes, integrating it into this larger kingdom that included Denmark, Britain, and later Norway, until Canute's death. So in 1042, his successors were warring over the leadership, and Edward the Confessor was crowned, restoring what was an English monarchy. The problem was Edward himself was also childless, which is a problem when creating a successful dynasty, and it's something that started a domino effect that would lead to the Norman invasion and the Battle of Hastings in 1066, and this new chapter in British history. Next time on the Shortest History of Britain, we look at the 11th century. We take a closer look at Canute the Great and Edward the Confessor, and how it all led to the great Norman conquest of 1066, its influence on government, language and society, and follow the country through to the coronation of Henry I in the year 1100. Thank you.